Blog Talk Radio.
November 12, 2009. This is your host, Doug Kelly, with Grant Rubendust.
Hey, welcome everybody. Getting closer to Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
What a wonderful time of year.
Yeah, and it's finally getting a little bit cooler here in Florida. So.
And a big salute to all of our veterans and our veteran listeners out everywhere. Lest we not forget that yesterday was Veterans Day.
Yeah. And yeah, definitely. And you know, we have our boys, a couple of our boys in the Army, one in Afghanistan right now. And anyway, so we're happy for that. We've got some interesting stuff to talk about tonight. We're going to focus on a number of things, near-death experiences. We've got Mark Anthony coming back to join us. We always love to have him back.
And we'll it's a pleasure to have Mark on the show again.
Just wanted to welcome everybody. If you've got questions on the show tonight, feel free to ask them in the chat room. If you'd like to call in with a question, you're welcome to do that too. The numbers are on your screen, or if you have a headset hooked to your computer, you can use that click to talk button that's on there. In the second half of the show tonight, in the last 30 minutes, we're going to be accepting calls from people who want readings from Mark. So we're going to only do that in the second half of the show. So if you call in before that, you're going to be on hold for a while. Anyway, well, we'll take the call to see if you have a question on what we're talking about. If you want a reading, you got to call in the second half. Let's see, what other housekeeping stuff do we have to talk about tonight? Things with Paranexus still going very well. Many of you know that we've incorporated recently as a nonprofit, and that's all going very well. And we are, of course, encouraging folks to come and join us who haven't joined us already. We have a lot of nice things going. We've got some great people on board with a lot of good experience, and we're looking for yours. So,
yeah, absolutely. And for those of you who have signed up as members, thank you very much, and welcome to Paranexus. Because you know we love having you, and we're here to support you and share the research with you. So, welcome on board. And for those of you who are not members, come on and join us.
Yeah, for those of you who are not members, what the hell's taking you so long?
Yeah, come on.
Anyway,
a lot of neat stuff.
And don't forget, too, if you haven't been to the website or read the newsletter, you know, membership dues are going up on December 1st. So if you want to get in at the lower rate, come and join us now. And don't forget that you get a lot of nice benefits with your membership, including web hosting. And that's got to, I mean, that counts for a lot right there. So come and join us, and we would love to have you. Now, one other thing I want to mention, I'm going to mention these again at the end of the show when more or different people are on. But in a couple of weeks, actually less than 2 weeks, we have a live broadcast of an investigation we're going to do in northwest Florida. And it's going to be an interesting investigation because it's kind of a combination of probably two or three different areas of the field. One, of course, hauntings, but we're also going to be looking at doing a Bigfoot investigation. Bigfoot's been sighted there, of course, in Florida. It's called the Swamp Ape or Skunk Ape. There's also been UFOs sighted, so we're going to be doing a broadcast. There's going to be a live table tipping facilitated by our own Gregory Kent, and it should be a very interesting thing. We're going to start it somewhere in the area of 10 o'clock or so at night. It's going to be a two-night thing. It's going to be a Monday night and a Tuesday night, the 23rd and 4th of this month, so it's the week before Thanksgiving. And We've got several investigators going to be on site. It should prove to be an interesting time. If you are a Paranexus member, there is no charge to view this live at our Paranexus website, paranexus.org. If you're not a member, you can still join in for a $10 donation to Paranexus. It includes both nights. And you even have access to a chat room, so it should be a fun time and an interesting time. With that having been said, let's get to the meat of our show tonight. We're welcoming back psychic lawyer Mark Anthony, who's been on our show several times. We always love to have him back. Mark, thanks for coming back again.
Yeah,
well, thanks,
Mark.
Doug. Thank you, Grant. It's great being back. This show is so much fun. I mean, it's like, you know, you ask people, what are you doing for Thanksgiving? Oh, we're going turkey hunting. Oh, go to my grandmother's. Oh, we're doing a Bigfoot hunt. And I mean,
well,
it's like,
come join us, Mark, you know.
You know, I'm sitting there thinking, God, if I could clear my calendar that week, how cool would that be? I mean, I guess I could sit around at Thanksgiving with my dysfunctional family, and we can all fight and argue, and I love them dearly. Or I could be out hunting Bigfoot. So, and assuming the Bigfoot, I guess they have families, and I wonder, are they intelligent enough to be dysfunctional? Maybe that could be the topic of a show once we catch one.
All right, I like that.
Yeah.
We just got to get them sedated and have them sit down with us for a little while.
Yeah, the Grant will host that when our Bigfoots, what do you say, Big Feets? Bigfoots, are they dysfunctional? They have
Big Feets family therapist. There you go. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, really. Well, cool. So tonight we're going to talk about a couple of things. One of them has to do with Friday the 13th. You mentioned that, Mark, is that a lot of people wonder why it's Friday the 13th. So, you know, it's got the reputation, the superstition. Well, I already have the answer. Let me just kick my answer out there right at the get-go here, right at the start. And the reason that Friday the 13th is considered to be an unlucky day is because I was born on Friday the 13th, and I took all of the good luck right out of that day.
That's
oh, my goodness.
It's a full phobia or something like that, isn't that right?
Wow. Yeah. Actually, there is a phobia about Friday the 13th. I forget the name of it, but I did see it when I was doing some research. I should have written it down. But wow. Well, that's quite amazing. I don't agree with your theory, because I think the world is a better place with you in it. So I don't think that you sucked all the goodness out of the world when you were born.
No, out of the day. I mean, I've got all the good luck that goes with that day, right? So
and you're not going to share any of it either. No.
People are very a lot of people are very suspicious and very cautious about Friday the 13th, and normally I do my when I do in-person readings, I do them on Friday afternoons, because that's when I'm usually clear to do that. And I had a number of people who refused to get a reading on Friday the 13th.
Really?
They thought, yeah, something evil would happen. And I assure people that, you know, there are no evil spirits that are going to come into our reading. And I don't conjure and I don't do anything negative. Everything I do is from a Christ consciousness, white light, positive, connect with God perspective. But the origins of the negativity of Friday the 13th, they go back over 700 years. And what happened was during the Crusades, and I'm a real history buff, and the Crusades I always found were fascinating for a whole number of reasons. But long story short, the objective, at least on paper, of the Crusades was for the Christians of Europe to recapture Jerusalem and the Holy Land, which is now in Israel, from Muslim control. And that was supposed to be a beautiful, happy, wonderful thing. What it turned into was a struggle for wealth and power and murdering people, and it was just a travesty. And in fact, when you look at the press releases and the videos and all that garbage that Al-Qaeda puts out, a lot of it references the Crusades. So in our European and American culture, we don't look at things that happened 1,000 years ago as having any relevance to what we're doing today. I mean, the average American, and no slight to my countrymen, but can't even remember what they had for breakfast yesterday, let alone what happened 1,000 years ago. And so in the Crusades, there was a military religious order known as the Knights Templar. And they got the name Templar because they seized the Temple Mound in Jerusalem, and that's where the Wailing Wall is, and that's where the Temple of Solomon from the Old Testament, which was destroyed by the Romans and laid in ruins, you know, to this day. And supposedly, the Knights Templar took possession of the Holy Grail. Now, whether or not that's true, I mean, you can read Da Vinci Code and all those books and think it off and all that. I don't know if that's true. But what happened with the Knights Templar is they set up a chain of banks, for lack of a better term, between Jerusalem all the way to England. And so if you were in with the Knights Templar, you could borrow money from them, and they would give you like a written receipt, and when you got to maybe Greece or Italy or France or wherever, you could turn that in for X amount of gold. Okay. Well, over the next couple hundred years, as the military need for the Knights Templar went away, the European kings started borrowing money from these guys. And, of course, they're charging interest. And as it would turn out, the kings couldn't pay their loans. It's a lot like what's going on today. Okay. And so the Vatican and the King of France, and it was one of the Philips, King Philip of France, they said, well, we can't afford to pay these loans back. And they're charging interest. Now, interest is a sin because that is the sin of usury. Yeah. So what happened was, yeah, well, it would be nice. I know when you get 0%. The Knight Templars weren't given 0% credit cards back in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
So long story short, all the Knights Templar were charged with heresy, witchcraft, usury, and a lot of sexual offense. They accused them of like bizarre satanic
and of course
they said they're homosexuals. And there was a day that they were all to be arrested. And this was very typical in the medieval era because they didn't have telecommunications. So they would plan something for 3 or 4 months ahead of time. And it just so happened that on Friday, October 13th, the year 1307, that was D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
So all throughout Europe, particularly in France and Italy, the Knights Templar were all rounded up, arrested, and charged with all these crimes of Satanism, witchcraft, and from that day on, Friday the 13th has been considered evil.
Huh.
And let me tell you, the fate that befell the Knights Templar was a horrible fate indeed. They were subjected.
Who was the one guy wasn't it? Philip de Molay or something like that, who was one of the Knights Templars who did some real heroic, made some heroic gesture, and wasn't he assassinated or something, or refused to admit under torture that they were conspiring with Lucifer or whatever.
Yes, and I mean these guys they were put in the Iron Maiden, like a coffin with spikes in it, and they would close it a little bit, and the spikes would go into you, and if you didn't tell them what they wanted here, they'd go more, and they had thumb screws and, I mean, branding irons in the rack. I mean, these guys were subjected to the worst, and of course, the vast majority of them admit it. I mean, if somebody is putting you on a rack and stretching your body to where your shoulders are being dislocated and actually ripped from their sockets, I would say I was Osama bin Laden. I mean, you would confess to anything, and
you
so they all confessed. Yeah, I mean, and that's you know.
We would have never got that far. My collarbones would have long been intact. I'd have written them a book.
So I would have taken one look at the rack and said, "Look, I'll sign anything. I'll sign anything you want."
I'm Beelzebub himself. I'm here in pure form. I'll sign off. Just get me off the damn rack. Yeah.
Well, the really terrible thing was when the Knights Templar, and pretty much anybody in the medieval era, when you were put on trial, you weren't allowed to speak. You weren't allowed to defend yourself. You weren't allowed a right to counsel. I mean, it was just a complete travesty. And now as an attorney, I can say that thank God that people like Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry and Benjamin Franklin and James Madison and John Adams were adept students of history, so that when they were formulating the Constitution and the idea, and I know Jefferson wasn't present during the Constitution, but his brain trust was a huge additive, but they were aware of these things. And that's why under our law there is no cruel and unusual punishment. So to get a confession out of someone, you don't beat them with rubber hoses or torture them. And also, that was one of the main reasons that they decided to separate church from state. Because whenever you have religion involved in government, bad things happen. And people say, but we need to get more religion in school. Well, let's look at Iran. There's a good example of a theocracy, or Saudi Arabia. Okay, so when you have a government that is controlled by religious fanatics, I don't want to live there. I mean, that's a horrible thing indeed. So that's why our country is truly amazing in so many ways, is because the people that put it together did understand these things. No, they were not perfect, and they did make a lot of mistakes, but they realized we can't have religion controlling government, and we also can't be employing the rack, branding irons, and thumb screws. Because even in England at the time, which was probably England of the American Revolution era, if you were arrested by the Crown and charged with a crime, they were going to get a confession out of you, and they weren't going to be nice about it. So that's one area where America did lead the way, and it's really a shame that in the last couple of years, so many people have accused us, maybe rightly so, of engaging in very coercive forms of interrogation. But I don't want to get off into all that. So when people say, "Ooh, Friday the 13th is a bad day," no, it isn't. Oh, it was a very bad day if you were a Knights Templar.
Yeah,
in 1307.
It was
about the worst day it could
be. Didn't Philip walk away with all their dough?
Absolutely. Oh, yes, and that was part
of it, because they had a lot of money, the Knight Templars did.
Oh, yeah, well, of course. Whenever you go and arrest somebody back in that area, you also seized their property. So all of a sudden, the European kings, they were on the plus side. They were no longer owing the Knights Templar money. They now have their vast treasure trove. So
Well, accuse them of all kinds of atrocities, and then it's easy to walk away with all their money. Who's going to question the king? So,
yeah, nobody. I mean, this was an era of the divine right of kings,
yeah.
And if the king said something, that's it. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And
what a scary thought, you know? What an incredibly scary thought to think that you could go from zero. I mean, from hero to zero within 24 hours and be executed. Yeah, that is, you know. But people knew that could be their fate, and it was just like, I mean, I'm sure they were just as shocked. But, you know, that was,
well,
it was
they
a
were
time.
Because they were also, the Knights Templar being a religious military order, many, if not all of them, were monks and priests. So They felt that, well, you know, we're part of the religious establishment. They're not going to do this. But when it comes down to it, you know, the King of France and the Pope had three things on their mind: money, money, and money.
Yeah,
and the Knights Templar got in the way of that, and how?
Well, they were the Jedi Knights of their time, just like the Zen Buddhists.
They were
for the Jedi Knights of their time, you know, and the Jedi Knights pay a price, you know, because they're just servants to whatever government they, you know, choose to become loyal to, and they pay the ultimate penalty for maintaining their ethics and their values. Sometimes,
absolutely, yes. That's a really cool way of putting it, Grant.
Well, let's talk about if any of those Knights Templar had any near-death experiences on the rack.
Well, I'm sure many did, eh?
Hey,
I bet they wanted to fast forward to the full-on death experience.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Near-death experience. Now, Grant, I understand you're quite well-versed in near-death experiences.
Yeah, I got my experience basically when I was working in the medical field right after I got out of college many years ago, working in the hospitals, and near-death experiences were coming to the forefront. And I just asked a lot of the nurses I worked with, and some of the patients. And surprisingly enough, a lot of the nurses had a lot of stories. And in some of my work, I've actually come across people who spontaneously told me that they had had near-death experiences. So it really fascinated me, and I have done a fair amount of research on it just for my own gratification, I guess. It's a very, very interesting area.
It is, and for the listeners who may not be familiar with the term, a near-death experience occurs when a person physically dies and then it either comes back to life or is resuscitated. Mm-hmm. And many of these people have experiences where they separate from their body, and oftentimes they are floating above their body and they're looking down at it, or they go into this tunnel and then they see this white light, and they're more often than not greeted by an intelligence, which they describe as God, in addition to deceased loved ones. And near-death experiences have been reported for thousands of years. In fact, it goes back to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and even Plato, in his book The Republic, wrote about a soldier by the name of Er, that's E-R, whose soul left the Cave of Shadows to see the light of truth. And in the New Testament, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 2 through 4, he wrote, "I know a person in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this person, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, but God knows, was caught up to paradise." Well, what does that sound like?
Mm-hmm. Well, the ancients were certainly aware of it, and you know the thing of it is too, Mark, is it's universal across all cultures. And
yes.
And folks that have different cultural beliefs perceive it in much the same manner. And oftentimes the experiencer, the person that's going through the near-death experience, will encounter family members or people that were instrumental in their lives, and in some cases have actual life reviews. But it can be very unique to each person. But the most interesting part, and I'm sure you'll agree, Mark, and I'll let you talk some more, is how the whole event changes the survivor's life. And usually the closer they are to actual clinical death, or if they've crossed it, it makes more of an impact in life changes longitudinally years after, if they survive their heart disease or whatever it may have been. So they're changed people.
It changes everyone that has a near-death experience. When I was in New York on business a couple months ago, I met a woman who was a medium, and she wanted to talk to me, and we had dinner, and it was great, you know, and just incredible person. And she was almost drowned, and, you know, they got her out of the water, gave her CPR, and she came back. And after that time, she then possessed mediumistic ability, which she had not showed before. And one of the very interesting side effects, if you will, of a near-death experience is that people's psychic and mediumistic abilities are enhanced. And I know this close up because my father has had two near-death experiences, and my father is a clairaudient medium. In other words, he can hear spirits. He doesn't see them and necessarily feel them in the way that I do, but he hears them. And so, and he's explained to me what that was like. And there's been studies conducted all over the world, and what they've concluded is that there's a list of things that are common to near-death experiences, whether they happen in England, India, China, Russia, Japan, Australia, you know, all over the world. They happen regardless of race, gender, age, education, marital, and social class. So in other words, everybody has them. The second is religious orientation is not a factor. In fact, even atheists have described this phenomenon. And what's very interesting about atheists is something that Nancy Evans Bush, president of the Emeritus of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, said. Most near-death survivors say they don't think there is a God. they know there is a God. And she reports that anyone that claims that they were an atheist before a near-death experience is no longer an atheist afterwards. Also, people lose their fear of death and appreciate life more after a near-death experience. And scientists do not believe that they're hallucination. In fact, Dr. Kenneth Ring, and he was involved in the University of Arizona's Survival of Consciousness Studies. Fascinating man. I've read a number of his books. I can't say enough good things about Dr. Kenneth Ring. Well, they decided in his study to focus on people who are blind since birth and have near-death experiences. And all of them gave visual accounts of what they saw when their spirit separated from their body. And there was a woman in Japan that had been blind since birth and described hovering above the operating table, it was during surgery, and how many people were in the room, what they looked like. She described colors for the first time in her life. So when the skeptics get in this and they say that, well, this is a phenomenon of a dying brain where you see a tunnel and you see a light and that's your brain dying, so you see all this. Well, if that were true, would not the brain only draw upon what it had experienced firsthand? And so a brain that had never been exposed to visual images, why would it, in the last moments of life, suddenly begin to experience sight? And so that's where the skeptics, I think, are really, really weak on that. Drugs do not appear to be a factor. Whether you're under anesthesia or you get into a car accident or you drown, near-death experiences have striking similarities. The other fascinating thing is, for the people who encounter relatives and friends, they only see people who are already dead. They don't see people who are currently alive when they go into this. So once again, if it was a hallucination, wouldn't you see all kinds of people? And one fascinating thing, and this is from Dr. Ring's book, or one of his books, I think Lessons from the Light. There's a woman in Japan who died, was resuscitated, and when she crossed into the light, she was greeted by her sister, whom she thought was alive. She did not know that her sister had actually died the day before. So, I mean, when you start seeing stuff like this, mm-hmm. it's amazing. Ben. And then my last, well, there are, and then let me tell this last one. Operating room, lady separates from her body, hovers above the light fixture, and notices all the dirt and dust on the top of the light fixture. Continues to hover through the ceiling up above the building, and she's on top of this hospital, and she notices a red tennis shoe in the rain gutter at the top of the hospital. Well, she comes back, and she talks about the dust on the light and the red tennis shoe, and the surgeon said, send somebody up there. And they found a red tennis shoe exactly where she said it was. So, well, I don't know how that's a phenomenon of a dying brain.
Let's just take a quick interruption for just a minute. I just wanted to let our listeners know that in this second half of the show now, we're going to be taking calls for readings. So if you would like a reading from Mark, please call. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799. Or if you have a headset, you can use your click-to-talk button on your computer. And just wanted to keep it as short as you can. Ask your questions, and then we'll move on to the next caller. So you guys.
Well, you know, if I can just add for a second here, Mark, you know, there was a research study that was published in The Lancet, I believe, 2001, and for those that aren't familiar with The Lancet, it's the British equivalent of the American Medical Journal. And one of the things that they found absolutely remarkable, and it dovetails what you were saying, is that at a time when the body is stressed and it's going through you've gone into cardiac arrest, well, the chemicals in your body have to be going completely haywire. Your biochemicals and all those sort of are responding to a crisis. And so when that sort of thing happens, you would expect the person's mentally to be incapacitated because of that. And one of the things that they found that's absolutely remarkable is when somebody is flatlined, in some of these cases, where there's absolutely no neural activity for a period of time, that these people can lucidly recall what was going on around them.
Yes.
In detail, just like you just accounted to. Now, one of the experiments that they wanted to do in Europe was to actually have a marquee strategically placed above the operating table so that if somebody was having an out-of-body experience, they could see the marquee. It wouldn't be obvious, but, you know, much like in the same idea of the tennis shoe, which, you know, is really a fascinating experience. But the other thing I want to really emphasize, that, and I know you'll agree with me on this, Mark, is how the medical community is embracing this now, where before they were standing off. I've seen Sanjay Gupta on CNN talking about near-death experiences, where 5 years ago he wouldn't have touched it with a 20-foot pole.
Yes.
Well, and what we're getting at is the redefinition of what constitutes consciousness as well.
Absolutely. I read an article, about 6 months ago about that, about consciousness. And all these scientists came to the conclusion that what we consider consciousness, what makes us who we are, is more than the sum of the parts. And the discussion is that the brain, the gray matter in our head, appears more for formatting. In other words, it's like a circuit board more than it is the actual consciousness. And of course, you know, those of us who are spiritualists and mediums, that's what we believe, is that the essence and what we are is a spiritual entity temporarily housed in this physical container, you know, which I've referred to as a meat suit and a blood bucket and, you know, all sorts of other things. But when this machinery, this that we're encased in physically ceases to function, so, you know, physical death, what we are goes on. And so the brain is a formatting instrument for processing data, but it isn't the what really is the data, and it really isn't what we are. So, which I find very comforting. I mean, I know so many people say, "Oh, when you're dead, and that's it," and so on and so forth. But I don't believe that because
well, they forget
in my
the physics, Mark. They forget
exactly.
The basic thermodynamics, you know. Energy can't be created or destroyed. It's got to go somewhere. It's got to have something happen to it.
Exactly. And the big question is, where does it go and what does it take with it? And does it stay coherent? And I love it when people say, well, I believe in science, and when you're dead, you're dead. And then and I say, well, what about energy neither, you know, being created nor destroyed, only transferred? Well, and where does it go? What does it do? Well, it dissipates. Well, all right, well, please show me which law of physics says that it dissipates. And all of a sudden, the science people get very unscientific mm-hmm. when they start jumping to those conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting. There was a Jesuit monk in the 19th century, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, but it came down to the greatest objective of God, of science, the greatest objective of science is the discovery of God. So what we're now seeing is that quantum physics is beginning to prove that our consciousness survives our physical death, that we are energy, and that we live on. And so it's only a matter of time before we get to the point where we will be able to prove this through the scientific method. And, you know, when people say, well, that's not scientific, well, then ask those people, prove the existence of love. And they go, well, and I did this to one guy, an avowed atheist who, you know, sat there looking at me with this vacuous look. And I go, well, you love your wife, don't you? He goes, I choose to love my wife. And I look at her and I go, how does that feel? You're just a choice.
Oh,
and she wasn't too happy about his response.
Yeah,
I said, and the thing is, you know, that's ridiculous. You don't choose to love somebody. How many times, how much control do you have over loving somebody? You love somebody because you connect with them. And how often have you know, listeners out there fallen in love with someone that was an absolute disaster? I mean, every logical fiber of your being said, do not love this person, don't even like this person, but you fall in love with them. So love is this invisible, unseen, unprovable force, which is a fact of our lives, but we can't put it under a microscope or test it or subject it to the scientific method. So if something like that exists, why can't our soul, our spirit, who and what we are, exist beyond our physical life?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, if I can butt in, you know, for just a second, Mark, I would encourage members of our audience, if you haven't gone to the International Near-Death Study, folks, you need to go. It's IANDS, IANDS, International Association of Near-Death Studies. They have Dr. Peter Fenwick with them and Dr. Samuel Parnia, and they have accounts of people who have actually undergone near-death experiences. And I would encourage you, if this interests you, to go to their website. They also have support groups, and if you are qualified or if you meet the qualifications, you may be able to actually participate in groups or in studies, because they do have this. So I would encourage you to go there and read some of their articles, because it's a terrific website and they do really good work.
And Grant, if I can expand on that, and for those of you out there who are coping with the loss of a loved one, and many times when we are consumed by grief, we want some answers. And certainly turn to God, absolutely. Turn to your religion, turn to your faith. But sometimes it's nice to read the scientific studies that are out there. And I have found, for many of the people that I counsel, that when you begin to understand the science and the studies, and you'll see that it validates our belief as people of faith, that the soul goes on. You can't kill a soul. I mean, I get people and as a medium, I get so many bizarre, some lady kept emailing me about, can you find his spirit? Because I know the spirit of my, you know, whoever it was destroyed by devils. And it's like, all right, let's stop with the primitive paranoid superstition. All right, devils aren't, number one, I don't believe in the devil, but number two, you can't destroy a soul, okay? That's just simply not something that happens. And for people that are grieving, for them to realize that their loved one didn't just disintegrate into dust, but has transcended to another level, then that, I find, is oftentimes very comforting.
Let's pick up on
grief
that
is, yeah,
real quick, Mark.
Sure.
Tell everybody your website, because you deal with that.
My website, and I do discuss these things on my website, is healgriefwithbelief.com. That's www.healgriefwithbelief.com. And there's a section on there called Bereaved Resources. And under there, a section on immortality of the soul and healing grief with belief. And I give a whole expose on world religions' understanding of the immortality of the soul, positive ways of coping with the loss of a loved one. And I believe that it is through our faith in God and through our faith in an afterlife that we can survive the pain and agony of grief. So my website's healgriefwithbelief.com, and also my contact information is there under schedule a session. I think I need to change that, because people all the time email me, how do I get a reading? And they ask me all those questions. I said, well, it's on the website. So it's called schedule a session,
yeah,
means
really
a reading.
So, and also you can, it's linked on our archives page on paranexus.org. Now, we just want to remind everybody, we've got about 20 minutes left on the show, and if you'd like a reading from Mark, feel free to call in. The number's there on your screen. And to get this going, Mark, would you be willing to do a reading on me?
Sure. I assume you're wanting to connect with somebody?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on.
No, I want to know if I'm going to get a job.
I know. All the mediums I know, we all hear, what's my love life, and tell me about my finances, and because those two things are plaguing everybody right now.
Well
you've got a female energy around you. This feels like a grandmother type of figure.
Really?
And I'm seeing a woman with kind of gray, almost bushy kind of hair, not like in an afro style, but kind of bushy, not quite to her shoulder length. Also see her wearing like a bathrobe and slippers, which indicates to me that she might have either been in a nursing home or was quite ill for some time before she passed. I'm also feeling that she was getting very thin before she passed, and it was hard for her to walk. She had a lot of respiratory ailments.
What kind of body type?
Medium to thin. Medium to thin is what I'm getting. And I'm getting like lots of spots on her hands, like those liver spots.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that when I say she's quite old, she was at least in her 80s, because when you look at her arms, you can see the blue veins going through them. And I also feel, Doug, that she was somewhat disoriented mentally. So in her final stages, I'm getting like either dementia. I don't think it was quite Alzheimer's, because I think she would come in and out, but she was confused a lot. And that's what she's saying, I was confused a lot. Does this make sense?
It could. Does she have any kind of message? Why is she around me? What is she here for?
Okay, hold on.
Well, I guess I can ask her, what can I do for you? Who are you?
No, you can hold on. Well, she definitely knew you when you were a little boy. And she knew you, I think, right around the time you got your first tricycle. And she showed me this weird hat that you used to like to wear. It's kind of like, I don't know, this goofy little hat, like a, it's kind of like a baseball cap, but not quite. And what she's saying is always how inquisitive, always inquisitive. And you were always like hands-on with things. You were the type of kid that would take a clock and take it apart and always picking through things. You weren't a bad kid. You weren't a behavior problem. But you never stop asking questions. Never stop asking questions. So let me see what the message she wants to give you.
That'd be great.
Do you have an older sister?
No.
Okay, because there's a woman that's older, that's either like a cousin, sister, friend. Let me see who that. What it was is you were a handful. Oh, it could be your mom. Give your mom, because she looks quite young, and of course, if you're like 3 or 4, she might have been, I don't know, in her 20s or early 30s or so. You were a handful, is what she's saying.
I was not.
And hold on. You haven't always lived in Florida, though. I'm getting.
Yeah. Very few people have. No, I haven't always been here, no.
Yeah, no, because wherever you lived, when you were real young, the autumn leaves, and there'd be piles of leaves, and you're like running and jumping in the leaves and throwing them all over the place. And it was, you know, it's just fun kid stuff is what you were doing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is when you had contact with your grandmother a lot. So you were a handful for your mom because you were an active kid, but you weren't like bad and negative like that. All right, so let me see what your grandmother wants you to know. You put way too much pressure on yourself. That's what her message is. You put way too much pressure on yourself emotionally, mentally, and part of the problem is it's as if you're burning the candle at both ends, and you're also not necessarily always watching out for your physical health. In other words, all the things that you're involved with come first, and taking care of yourself, your diet, watching, you know, some of the things that you eat is kind of a lower priority.
Yeah, I can't argue with that one.
What else she's got to say.
And I'd have to give up fried chicken.
I don't know if you... Okay.
Too many bear claws at the 7-Eleven.
Well, it's she's showing me fish, and it's like I don't know if you like going fishing, but I don't think that's it. It's like eating fish, which indicates to me omega-3 fatty acids, which get into a cholesterol issue, which she would like you to address. So, I mean, I don't know anything about your medical history, but that
how
is something.
Bad can it be? You know, I'm announcing. You can talk about it. You can say whatever.
She's not saying that it's bad or heart attack is coming, but when I see that particular image, that's what that means is you need to incorporate more foods into your diet to be more aware of your cholesterol levels. Okay.
Okay, cool. Interesting. Yeah, the certainly was active and certainly asked a lot of questions and certainly took a lot of things apart. Oh, yeah. That was interesting. Well, folks, I mean, if you'd like a reading from Mike, we're getting low on time, so, you know, call on up. Don't be shy. We're informal here. We're real human beings just like you, and it's not scary at all. Well, not.
Believe it or not, we are. I don't know about Doug, but I put my pants on one leg at a time. Just kid, folks.
Yeah, well, you'd have to levitate to do it any other way, wouldn't you?
That's absolutely correct, or have a Hoyer lift or something, a bulldozer. But
yeah, that's interesting.
You know, it's really fascinating stuff when you think about all the possibilities that come along with consciousness and how it's all interrelated to some real frontier areas of science right now. And I think we're heading towards a real paradigm shift within the next, I would say within the next 10 years, medically, about what the actual definition of death is.
Yeah,
I think so, yeah. The advances are there, and I think we talked about this on a previous show. Even Thomas Edison theorized that you could create a device that might be able to communicate with the dead, because his belief was that it all has to do with frequency. And, you know, when we tune in mediumistically, that's what we're doing is we're tuning into, I'll call it a higher frequency and a vibration, because when people leave their bodies, that's what they do. They're an energy field. They're a frequency then. But they're still a coherent, thinking, living spirit. So you're not just sort of a memory wafting around, because they can interact. I mean, if, for example, I don't know anything about your medical history, Doug. I don't know about your cholesterol or your personal habits. But if any of that stuff is accurate, okay, then how can I possibly get that? You know, I'm on the phone talking to you.
We've
never met in person. We've talked, you know, a couple times on the phone. But what this shows is that your loved ones are still connected to you. They're in a collective consciousness that we call the other side, and she's over there, and she's aware of what's going on in your life. And when they can get a message through, now, granted, if we're doing a one-on-one type reading, you know, you're going to get more, I'd say, profound messages.
But for
right now, the message she needed to get through to you was, you need to watch out for these particular things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And, you know, we don't always get the mysteries of the universe conveyed by spirit from the other side.
That's what I'm looking for, Mark. I mean,
Sometimes we do. I mean, I do some readings for people, and stuff comes through that's like, whoa. I was doing a reading for a lady today on the phone, and her, I don't know, some grandmother or great-grandmother, it was somebody like that, and the message was, God is real and you don't pray enough. And so I convey that to the lady. She's like, oh, my God. She started freaking out, you know. I'm like, okay, I guess that meant something to you.
Yeah.
And it was very relevant for her.
Probably heard it when she was in the flesh, huh?
Yeah.
God's real.
I'm surprised we don't have any callers tonight. I guess everyone's...
I'm shocked, too. I mean, our last show was nothing but callers. And
yeah, we got a lot last time. But, you know, we can always slip back into the near-death experience, you know, because that's... There's still plenty to talk about.
Well, the whole thing, and as it relates to consciousness.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dr. Peter Fenwick, who's I think he's a neuro or a psychoneurobiologist or something, You know, he said the same thing you just said, Mark. He just basically said that, or what you talked about a little bit earlier about how our gray matter is just tuned to one single frequency, and he thinks that these survivors sometimes have just tuned in or momentarily been allowed to tune into that higher consciousness because their frequency has been raised because physiologically there's been some sort of release or who knows. But wasn't there somebody many years ago too, Mark, that weighed people's bodies after they died and actually came up with like there was like he clearly said it was around the turn of the century that it was the person's soul.
Yes.
Because it became lighter at the time of death.
21 grams.
Yes.
21 grams. But, you know, I've read about that, and that has been so picked apart. And,
well, of course.
So that one, as much as I would like to believe that, there's not enough data to back that one up. And the skeptics are saying that when a body exhales,
it's going to reduce fire.
Yes, exactly. So, but I thought that would be really cool because energy does have, you know, mass to it, and you know, but I thought that would have been a fantastic thing if they could have proven that.
One of the things I think that I wish we could do, and I proposed in an experiment one time in graduate school, a near death experiment to you know have a immediately whisk them into an MRI, you know, just see if there's any brain activity. I know physically the logistics of that are probably not possible. Maybe when we have real portable ones someday in the future where you could do a brain scan immediately and see, you know, if there's any activity at all.
There was a study that Dr. Ring talks about in one of his books that when people flatline the right frontal lobe of your brain, there's a tremendous amount of activity going on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd like to see more studies on what they think is happening there. So
well, some people like Susan Blackmore and a few of the skeptics have said what that is that's that energy that's just dispersing, releasing because the cells are dying and all that electrical energy can't be composed in those cells any longer. So, you know,
so many of those atheists and the skeptics, they're so mired in what I consider to be negativity. They don't want there to be a heaven. They don't want there to be any type of afterlife. They don't want there to be a God. And if you try to explain things to them, they don't want to hear it. And what it comes down to is some people you're never going to be able to persuade because all these things are based on your personal experience. And, you know, somebody was telling me, well, you can't prove this to me, and you can't prove that to me, and da-da-da-da-da. And I said, well, you know, and I'm not comparing myself to him for one second, but not everybody believed Jesus either. And not everybody believed Muhammad, and not everybody believed Buddha, and not everybody believed Krishna. So, you know, I'm certainly nowhere near those guys, and certainly nowhere near as special as they are. So if I can't get some narrow-minded atheist that thinks that when you're dead, that's it. Hey, that's what you want to believe. You have a right to believe that. And
so maybe you create that reality for yourself, too. There's been people like I talked about earlier that have had their experiences. There have been negative experiences. They're not that popular, but they now call them disturbing. Or not disturbing, they call them distressing NDEs. And, you know, people have had experience where they feel like they're floating in nothingness. And they're the only person there that's been left alone. There was a guy, I'm sure you remember this one, Mark. There was a fellow who was a college professor who was traveling in Europe and an avowed atheist. And he had an incident where he had some sort of problem, stomach problem. I don't know whether he had an aneurysm or something. And he was hospitalized and, you know, he actually died. And when he died, he found himself, by his claim, in this very dark place, and he was really scared, and he felt some very negative energy around him. And here he was, like this atheist in a foxhole, and as a last resort, because he was afraid, he started praying, and it all went away, and the experience turned very positive for him. So positive, in fact, that this guy who was prior to his near-death experience, was an avowed
atheist. Yeah.
Now became a minister.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, that's
this
one
is
of those
true case.
Well, sure. I remember reading about that guy, and you know, it's like, and I'm not a biblical fundamentalist, but I do read the Bible because there's so much in there. And when Saul, who we know as Paul, was knocked off his horse and saw the light, I mean, that very much sounds like a near-death type of experience. And the passage that I read earlier from Corinthians, many scholars theorize that Paul was actually writing about himself, that you know, he had this near-death experience. So when a spirit crosses over onto the other side, most often they go into the light. A lot of people ask me about, well, what about the dark realm? Well, there are darker, I mean, I call them darker for lack of a better description, dark levels to the other side, but you're not condemned to it for eternity, and you can ascend out of it based on the decisions that you make there. So in other words, your free will is not just here in the material world, but it carries on over into the spiritual world.
Hey, we got a question from the chat, too, so we've
super.
Got some 3 minutes. Sharon wants to know, what's your definition of consciousness? And we've got about two and a half minutes, real quick.
My definition of consciousness.
What's the meaning of life in 2 minutes?
Good luck, Mark.
Well, consciousness is your ability to be self-aware, to realize that you do exist, that you are alive, and that there is more to your existence than just right now. And that's the difference between us and what scientists theorize how animals think. Animals don't reflect on what happened yesterday, and they don't worry about what's going to happen to tomorrow or think about that. Okay, I'm not saying that their life force doesn't go to the other side, but the fact that we have a consciousness, which is a self-awareness, a self-identity, and also as you enhance your consciousness, your ability to get into contact with your higher self, excuse me, which is the spiritual dimension of our existence here. Because as it's theorized by my English mentors and friends, that we are a multidimensional being. We're having a material world existence along with a spiritual existence. And our higher spiritual self is having a different experience than we are here. So that is what I would briefly describe as consciousness.
Well, cool. And that's great. Go ahead.
Well, and what I can say is, based on my contact with spirits on the other side, when you die, you take your memories with you, you take your love with you, you take your experience with you, you take your identity. To sum it up, when you die, you take you with you.
That's a good short explanation. All right. So we're on the home stretch here. We've just got about a minute left. Be sure and visit Mark's website. Could you repeat that again, please, Mark?
HealGriefWithBelief.com.
Great. And you can also get his website on our website, Paranexus.org, in the archives section that you'll see there for the radio program. And in our last few seconds on the air, I just want to remind everybody to come and visit us at Paranexus.org. Please take a look at joining us. We are a nonprofit. We are doing anomalous research, and we think we have a pretty cool thing going with a lot of great people. So come and join us and share your expertise. Also, in about a week and a half, on November 23rd and 4th, we're going to be doing a live investigation that encompasses both a Bigfoot investigation as well as a haunting and even a UFO investigation. So we're going to broadcast that live on two nights. Members, it's free, and for non-members, it's $10 for both nights. And we'd love to have you join us there, too. More information is at paranexus.org. Mark, it's always great having you. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing or talking with you guys again.
Yeah, we'll have you back on the show.
It was great having you here, Mark. Always a pleasure.
And we appreciate our listeners. Yeah, you take care, Mark. And we also thank our listeners tonight. Next week, Dr. John Turner will be joining us for an interesting show. And with that, we bid you adieu. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.